From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, also columnist for Dow Jones and USA Today. Joining me on the panel, Nahal Tusi. She is the foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and Dan Raviv, an experienced foreign correspondent and columnist for Newsday, also the author of several books on the Middle East. Well, welcome to both of you. And of course, because of this terrible coronavirus, we are speaking with each other via Skype this week. I think we're going to be doing that probably for a while. This virus continues to inflict just a terrible toll all around the world in terms of both lives lost and economic damage. The epicenter for it now appears to be here in the United States. As we speak, the number of cases is closing in on 250,000, and the death toll has topped 5,000. Dan, let's start with you. The numbers I just mentioned, they are accelerating quickly, and even President Trump says things are going to get a lot worse.
And keep in mind that President Trump, especially in the month of February, tried to minimize the dangers of coronavirus to the United States. He often called it the Chinese virus. He said that his administration was very successful at preventing it from coming to the U.S. What he was boasting about for a very long time is that he banned all flights coming in from China. And indeed, medical experts say that did have some effect of protecting America to a degree for a while. But in the United States, certainly critics of President Trump say that his administration did not make many efforts to get a lot of medical equipment ready. And so now we're at the stage, now that it's April, where hospitals all over the United States, worst of all in the state of New York, and worst of all in the city of New York, hospitals are overwhelmed. They don't have enough equipment. People are coming in. They obviously have the coronavirus. They're finding it hard to breathe. The number of deaths has been increasing every day. And only a few days ago at the White House, in the daily briefing, the president and his top medical advisors gave a number that, well, even the newspapers here said was grim. Others wrote that it was frightening, that if things go well, the United States is likely to suffer about 200,000 deaths from coronavirus. The president said if we hadn't done anything, the experts say it would have been over 2 million deaths. And so the president says we've done a really great job. And obviously the administration, the Trump administration, is scrambling now to get medical equipment. But critics say that it's not well organized at all. So it's become a crisis here in the U.S., Paul.
And you know, Dan, the president a couple of days ago said, I'm not sure this was the best choice of words, he said he was feeling good that the death toll might only be, and I use that in air quotes, might only be a couple of 100,000 because of these mitigation efforts. But if you look around the United States, we've got 50 states here, and there are about a dozen states that are not doing all of that much to quarantine their residents and enforce this social distancing thing. And that includes two of our biggest states, Texas and Florida. I think Florida is now taking some steps here. But this mitigation that the president has been talking about now, how that appears to be kind of a mixed picture here.
That's right. It's a bit of a patchwork. And it's one of the things that's kind of hard to tell is how much politics plays a role in this. Sometimes there's an effort to say, oh, this is kind of a red state versus blue state thing. But it's not entirely always clear that that's the case. I mean, Mike DeWine, the governor of Ohio, is a Republican, and he's been one of the leaders in trying to impose mitigation in his state. But then you have Ron DeSantis of Florida, who until just yesterday, basically, was not putting in those kinds of efforts. And he's a big Trump ally. And there's a sense that maybe he was trying to kind of go along with whatever the president kind of signals that the president was sending in terms of the seriousness of it. And Florida in particular is a really sensitive issue because not only is it a swing state politically, but also it has a fairly large number of elderly people who live there because a lot of Americans retire to Florida. And so they were in unusual danger. And I think that's one state where I think things are probably going to get worse before they get better in terms of the number of cases.
In fact, we've heard some reports from Florida about the outbreaks at some fairly large retirement communities, in fact. So it's certainly something to worry about there. You know, we also keep, and this is for anybody who wants to answer it, we keep hearing that vaccine for this coronavirus is perhaps as much as 18 months away, a year and a half away. And during this period, experts say that a virus could return, a second wave, perhaps even a third wave. And when you look back at prior pandemics, of course, the big one about a century ago, this influenza pandemic that swept the globe, that was about three separate waves, I think. So we are really in a race against time here, Dan.
Well, whenever I'm on issues in the news, I feel like I'm the optimist. I hope somehow you share that as well. But I have to say that medical research is incredibly better in the year 2020 than it was in 1918 when that flu caused tens of millions of deaths. And so I'm optimistic that some of the greatest medical researchers, some of them are at corporations, some of them at governments here in the United States and in other countries as well, will come up with treatments, will come up with, in fact, a vaccine. Yes, the whole process, including testing a vaccine that would inoculate people and hopefully make them immune to this virus, that the process of developing one, testing it on people, making sure it's safe, and then if it's safe and effective, then you put it into mass production, that would take at best a year. That's true. He said that. But that, of course, is terrific. That would be a breakthrough. Perhaps my hopes are a little bit higher for some kind of treatment that would help the people who've been hospitalized. What's happening now in the intensive care units of hospitals, and again, especially again, New York City, perhaps worst of all, but other trouble spots here in the United States, the president calls them hot spots, include the Seattle area in the state of Washington. And they want a treatment. I mean, they're keeping people alive by putting the patients on ventilators that help the patients breathe. But sometimes the coronavirus has done its damage. You want a medicine that is especially tailored to reverse the effects of COVID-19, this coronavirus, and several drug companies say they have made progress and the testing has begun. And so I'm thinking as an optimist that perhaps the weather, the climate will mean that in the autumn and the colder months, we won't have this problem. But you're right. There's the prediction of a second wave still to come. I just think there's a chance that we'll be much better prepared than we were a century ago.
Well, I think we can certainly all agree on that and hope for that. There have been reports in parts of China, also in Singapore, which is a very sophisticated city-state, obviously, of perhaps a second wave already emerging. But like you say, let's certainly keep our fingers crossed here. Nahal, do you have an opinion on that?
I would just say we also have to think about this in global terms. You know, a lot of the places that have yet to be hit are the developing countries and places, continents like Africa, countries like India, and they, like, I feel like in some ways the worst is yet to come, and they don't have the kind of public health infrastructure that even the U.S. has. So, you know, in terms of this, the waves, I think we have to figure out what can be done to help those countries. Otherwise, we could be talking about years and years of waves of coronavirus coming back.
How is this even, you know, there have been warnings, despite what people in the Trump White House say, there have been warnings for quite some time that something like this was going to happen. Why did we let our guard down in the face of so many warnings that this was going to happen?
Well, look, part of it, I think, genuinely has to do with the fact that when the Trump administration took over from the Obama administration, there was a sense among the Trump political appointees that everything that the Obama team had done was not worth looking at. So they didn't really take the warnings and stuff as seriously as they might have. Like, and I mean, this is just from my reporting, from the fact that we know that the Obama team did a transition exercise for the Trump team that included a pandemic scenario. We know that the National Security Council, the career government employees left a detailed 70-page pandemic playbook for the Trump administration to follow in case exactly this type of scenario happened. And you know, from what I was told, it was basically thrown onto a shelf and not really looked at. So I think part of it was just this kind of lack of trust between the two administrations, this kind of partisanship that has really in some ways hobbled the U.S. response to this on so many levels. And yeah, but you're right. I mean, this is, people have been warning about this for years. People have made movies about this. I mean, there was a movie called Contagion just a few years ago that basically tracked exactly what's happening now. And the one thing that it really didn't consider was the possibility that the U.S. government was going to, you know, not be as reactive as it could be and not be leading the world in the response.
And just one further example, of course, there's a report out just in the last day or so on how key contract run out with the one firm that maintains the U.S. ventilator stockpile. So it's things like that that are really rearing their ugly head now here. So clearly, a lot of this is absolutely appears to be on the Trump White House, Dan.
I wonder if voters will see it that way, because let's keep in mind we have an election 7 months away. And in November, the American people will have to decide, will Donald Trump have a second four-year term, or will a Democrat be elected? It looks in the Democratic Party like Joe Biden, the former vice president, will be the candidate for the Democratic Party. But this campaign has really been almost paralyzed. What is Joe Biden able to do for his own safety, for his own health? He's at home in Wilmington, Delaware. He's doing television and radio interviews from his basement. No rallies are planned. The other Democrat who's running for the party nomination, Senator Bernie Sanders, also can't do much except give interviews. And he's getting pressure from other Democrats to drop out of the race, to at least let Joe Biden be the candidate. And Donald Trump is, in a sense, running for re-election by being visible every day, typically for more than an hour and a half at a briefing at the White House that's mostly about the coronavirus. But the president goes on and tells other stories about other initiatives, makes big claims, says things are great, claims that the U.S. economy will bounce back very quickly. And it could well be that the United States is suffering from our system of government. In some ways, we're very proud. We're unique. The 50 states of the United States have a lot of power over their own territory. And so even President Trump has said that he's leaving it up to the governors to decide whether their state will have a policy that you can't go out except for essential reasons. As you said, Paul, there are quite a few states. Texas was not willing to issue those orders. Florida was reluctant to do so. But when you look at it on a world scale, it was reported this week that actually 2.5 billion people around the world are under some form of instruction from their government to stay home. India, by the way, is about half that number. When right. Just this past week, India told 1.3 billion people, everybody, to stay inside except for essential reasons. But in the United States, that is not a national instruction. And that, frankly, means that the virus will keep spreading as people still congregate, still do go out, and still travel. Certainly not all Americans. We see it in the number of people who have filed for unemployment insurance, which went way up this past Thursday. Paul, you had the number at the White House. How many million?
It was an additional 6.6 million, which means in the last 2 weeks alone, about 10 million Americans. And I just got off the phone before coming on here with the chief economist at a major Wall Street firm. Their prediction is 20 million Americans could lose their jobs simply in the month of April alone. And even the Federal Reserve says 47 million could lose their jobs in the second quarter. These are just catastrophic numbers here.
Absolutely. And, you know, but it comes as Congress has been, they've already passed like three-phase bills in terms of stimulus package. We're talking trillions of dollars they're pumping into the economy. And they're talking about another one. Speaker Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi of the Democrats wanted to include a massive infrastructure package. The idea being that if the U.S. spends a ton of money on infrastructure, everything from, you know, roads to buildings to expanding broadband and Wi-Fi access, that will create thousands of jobs and then we can help the economy recover. Now, the president is a fan of this idea in general. He has wanted to have a big infrastructure bill for a long time, but it's the Republicans and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, who seem hesitant for now. They want to see how the ongoing stimulus packages play out. Now, again, maybe that 6.6 million jobless figure will, you know, perhaps light a fire under the Republicans to go ahead and have a new stimulus package.
Let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on VOA's website at voanews.com. Now back to our panel, Nahal Tusi. She is the foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. And Dan Revive, he's a columnist for Newsday, also the author of several books. You know, Nahal, we were talking before the break about where this coronavirus began. Obviously, in China, it's raced across Asia, all across Europe. Italy and Spain have been particularly hard hit. And Dan mentioned how I think 2.5 billion people around the world, half of them in India, have been told to sort of a self-quarantine. But here's the question, though. China now claims that the virus has subsided. There are stories about factories reopening, people going back to work and such. And the numbers in Italy appear to be going down a little bit as well. Now, I personally don't believe much of what China says, but what do you think about these reports?
Well, look, it's intended to offer some hope. And I think there's without a doubt, you know, the belief and that mitigation measures do help, that they will reduce the numbers. At some point, you can flatten the curve. But, you know, we know there have been reports that U.S. intelligence officials believe that the Chinese are not being straightforward about their numbers, that they're saying that the numbers are much lower than they really are, especially the deaths. I mean, there's reports out of Wuhan City and Hubei Province in China that there are thousands and thousands of urns being handed back to families, you know, with the remains of their loved ones. But the official figure, the death figure, is much, much lower than that. So people just don't really know what to believe with the Chinese. And at the same time, the Chinese have done all sorts of things. They've made claims that this originated in the U.S., that maybe the U.S. military came up with this virus and planted it in China. And they're going around offering help, equipment, expertise, and others to other countries as a bid to kind of make themselves seem like they are the global leaders. So there's this propaganda fight going on with them. And, you know, I think it's just given the way that this virus has gone, although the Chinese did take drastic measures without question, the numbers coming out of China are they're tough to believe.
You know, Dan, and Nahal just made a really good point about some of these measures that China has taken. You know, that the things that they have done, we cannot do here in the United States. And they've been quite forcible about some of the measures they have taken in an open society like the United States. You can't do that, right?
It certainly seems that way. You get governors issuing orders for their states. This past week, the state of Maryland, the governor actually told everyone it would be a violation of the law to be outside or to gather in any groups at all. And then there was a list of exceptions. It said you can go shopping for food and you can go shopping to the drugstore, to the pharmacy. It even said you could go out and exercise. And there it was like recommending that you should stay only with people who live in your household so you're not spreading the virus to anyone. But it all felt really like a recommendation. Oh, maybe here and there police are issuing a ticket, kind of like a traffic infraction to discourage people from going out and mixing. But, you know, America has this phrase about itself that this is the land of the free, but if we're the home of the brave, maybe we should be courageous enough to stay at home, not mix with other people, and don't spread the virus. But it is rather voluntary. We can't imagine that there'll be police and troops on the streets pushing people back into their homes, using acetylene torches to seal the front entrances. These are things that even China's official media were showing a couple of months ago in order to tell the Chinese people, we mean business, you can't go out. Now, again, we don't know how successful it was in China, because I'm with you, Paul, we don't know if we can believe the numbers, but China claims to have been quite successful in mitigating the coronavirus, which did begin in China, did come from there. I'm not saying China's necessarily to blame, but American officials don't know whether to believe it. President Trump, he spoke with President Xi Jinping on the phone. Later, the president said it was a great discussion. It was mostly about the virus. Maybe China's official numbers are, quote, a little bit light, as President Trump put it, but China has been terrific and has even sent some aid, some medical equipment to the United States. The president also thanked and praised Russia for sending a plane load of supplies to New York. Obviously, Russia was proud enough to claim that it can do that. And, well, President Trump was saying thank you to both China and Russia.
You know, I'd like to add that I don't trust the Russian numbers necessarily either. So, yeah.
Well, Moscow, which is a city about the size of New York, has been ordered to lock down as well, which suggests how bad things are in Russia. You know, in the remaining minutes that we have, I want to kind of do something different with both of you. We've been talking about the economic damage, the toll in terms of human lives, what it might mean for the U.S. presidential election. Take a step back from all of that, if you could, and give us kind of your general observations on how this virus, this terrible coronavirus, is changing the world in terms of how we live and how we work. And what do you think might emerge when all of this is over? We don't know when it'll be over, but what do you think might emerge when it does finally go away?
Well, for me, it's kind of a blessing and a curse. I mean, I'm something of an introvert. I don't necessarily like hanging out with people. It can be a bit nerve-wracking for me. So being alone at home is not necessarily something, I mean, I kind of enjoy it sometimes. But I think one thing that's kind of driving me crazy is just this increased reliance on technology. Like, I've actually been trying to like cut back on that. And instead, now I'm having to download all these new apps to, you know, do everything from talking to friends to talking to my colleagues for work meetings on Zoom. And I mean, I'd gone for like years avoiding Slack, but now I have no choice. I have to be on Slack. So I think, you know, our reliance on technology, I think, is going to grow. And that's something that I'm not sure that I personally really am thrilled about. But on the other hand, maybe this will like help us also remember, for some of us who are perhaps more extroverted, like how wonderful it is to have human contact, how important it is to help one another and to, you know, support one another during times of crisis.
Nahal, I know you can do that from your home too, so thank you. But for someone who I guess is more social, that would be me, I'm not very happy. I'm generally at home. Luckily, I have a wife here, and actually my grown children are in the Washington, D.C. area, and at least one of them is often at our home with his wife and their baby. And so we've decided that we're kind of a health group. You know, we're all going to avoid the coronavirus together and be very careful, etc. So luckily, I'm not home alone. But yeah, we have to adjust. And as for the long run, I mean, I'm noting, for instance, that the companies that own commercial property in the big American cities, you know, the office buildings, they're really worried about the future, because companies and workers may not need the offices anymore. In a few months, a lot of people and companies may realize we don't need offices. Most of our workers can be at home, and they're saving a lot of time by not commuting to work and driving. And so that's going to help with pollution. Cars aren't selling well. That's in part right now because a lot of folks aren't leaving their homes. But will they still need their cars? Will they go anywhere? I think there are going to be a lot of changes. Even if this lasts just a few months, it's very dramatic.
A lot of those trends were kind of accelerating even before this crisis occurred. Those are all really good points, Dan. It is true that sort of commercial real estate, just here in the Washington area alone in the past 4 or 5 years, about 8 million square feet of office space, for example, now converted to residential housing, because these companies realize that, look, corporations are cutting back. They don't need all the space. And that's a good point, too, with people driving less, working from home, less stress on the roads, I suppose. That's good. Also, big developments in things like telemedicine. You can consult your doctor online, and stories about schools that have now shifted to online learning. That was big even before this crisis, but you get the sense that that is only going to get bigger. I think the other thing to worry about also is, when this is over, are we going to be complacent again about getting on an airplane or going into a crowded restaurant, that kind of thing? And will we ever shake hands again to hear about things like that?
I hope anybody? So.
No. That's interesting. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Nahal Tusi. She is the foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Dan Raviv, veteran foreign correspondent, also the author of several books on the Middle East and a columnist for Newsday. This program is produced by Voice of America's Kim Lewis. And I'm Paul Brandis. Thanks for listening.